Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. A persuasive case can be made that when charged with a crime, criminal or civil, defendants of means have a better chance for a positive outcome than those who are poor. One reason is because they are better able to afford legal representation. It's been 51 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Gideon v. Wainwright that poverty should not be a barrier to legal representation when those who cannot afford an attorney are accused of a crime. That ruling led to creation of the public defender system. But there is still a gap in meeting the legal needs and outcomes of those who are wealthy and those who are not. It's called the justice gap. I'm Don Marsh. On today's program, we'll be discussing the gap and efforts to close it. Joining me in studio, Dan Glaser, Executive Director of Legal Services of Eastern Missouri, which provides legal assistance to the poor and elderly. Thomas Harvey is co-founder and executive director of Arch City Defenders, an organization that seeks to remove barriers to justice for the poor. Rick Kroger is deputy district defender for the Missouri Public Defender System. Full disclosure here, my son is a public defender in St. Louis. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you.
Thank you, Don.
Nice to be here.
Dan, let me begin with you. I have a note here that says someone once said that America has the best justice system that money can buy. Is that accurate?
Oh, it's we have a great justice system in terms of the quality of the lawyering, the quality of the now technological things that are all there. But absolutely, it is in fact unquestionably a income-based disparity. It makes a real difference, whether you are. The bottom line is, the most important thing is, if you have a lawyer, things should be going better. And the question for the work that we do at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri is having, making sure that we have the funds to ensure that we can have lawyers for everybody that that needs our help. And that's where the problem is. If you get a lawyer, things are going to go much better than if they don't. But if you don't, it's kind of like I'll use the analogy of, if I tried to fix my own car, all right, you don't want to do that. You don't want to go into court without good, competent representation.
Where do you get your funds, by the way?
Well, our funds come from a variety of different sources. One of them is the National Legal Services Corporation. That provides about 30% of our money. Another 50% of our money comes from a variety of grants, foundations. We have a filing fee in the state of Missouri that goes to the four legal aid programs in the state of Missouri. And then the third source is our community, the goodness of the community that we work with. That's really sort of the three pyramids, the three anchors of what we do.
Well, let me turn to Thomas Harvey now and ask you about this justice gap. I would have to assume you're going to agree with Dan.
I agree completely. The primary gap exists between people who have an attorney and people who don't have an attorney. It's in the work that we do at the Arch City Defenders is focused on helping the homeless remove legal barriers that prevent them from getting on with their lives. And those folks obviously can't afford an attorney at all. And so many of the services that we provide aren't available at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri or at the Public Defender. And so we provide those services to help those folks get back on their feet. If they didn't have an attorney, they would not be able to navigate that system, first of all. It's our 91 municipal courts that each have their own – our 91 municipalities, which have their own court, each have their own police force, and each can issue ordinance violations for a multitude of things that poor people run into all the time. And it may sound like a minor thing, but a traffic ticket and a warrant that comes as a result of a non-payment of that traffic ticket can really disrupt a person's life, especially if they're already on the margins.
And Rick Kroger, the public defender's office does provide the service, does provide the attorneys. How do you see this justice gap?
Well, I see it. There are a number of things that are involved in it. Obviously, the number of cases that a public defender has varies throughout the state, but they're always high. They're always higher than a private attorney has. Private attorney has the ability to say, I have enough. I'm not going to take any more. Private attorney has the ability to say, I'm not going to take this case because you want a trial. I'm not going to take it for a variety of reasons. And we don't have that. So our attorneys are constantly running up against the fact that they have a number of clients, most of whom are confined, few of whom have the ability to really get out and help us find their witnesses, find the people we need for their trials, for their cases. So there is a gap. There's a gap, but I don't think there's a gap within our office in the sense of if a person gets a public defender, they're going to have a lesser attorney than if they have a private attorney. I think the gap just comes with in terms of what sort of resources we have. But I think the attorneys that an individual will get from the public defender system are equal to or greater than most, if not all, of the private attorneys out there.
Do you think the situation in our area is, Dan, fairly typical of what it's like throughout the country?
Yes, I do. The justice gap exists nationwide. To give you a statistic, just to have a sense of what we're talking about, nationwide, basically for legal aid lawyers, you know, which is what we are and what we do, there are about approximately there's about one legal services legal aid attorney for every approximately 6,500 people. And compare that to the private sector, where there's approximately one attorney for every approximately 429 people. So, I mean, right away, I'm no math major, and it's not my strength, but you can see that gap incredibly there. So
it's a numbers game. We can't say that the attorneys who are in the private sector are better attorneys, Rick, as you have indicated.
Right.
You're all educated the same way in the same schools.
Yes.
It's a numbers game.
I mean, I'm sorry.
It is, but I would have to disagree with Dan just a little bit in terms of Missouri. Maybe not so much in the legal aid area where they deal with civil stuff. I think that Missouri, we have one of the lower funded public defender systems nationwide. So I think that does increase the gap.
Yeah.
In Missouri in a way that it's not the same in other states. I think that, you know, you look at the Bronx Public Defender, you look at other organizations around the nation where they have not only the attorneys, but they have social workers who can help deal with issues like Thomas is dealing with in terms of, okay, the public defender is going to represent you on this felony, but when that's done, you're still going to have all these other issues in terms of mental health, in terms of homelessness,
right,
in terms of smaller things. And other public defender systems around the nation have the resources to deal with those, and we don't.
Go ahead, Thomas.
Well, and that does speak to the services we provide, because we are taking criminal and civil cases. That's kind of represent the spectrum here in the room, where legal services handles civil cases and doesn't have the purview to handle criminal cases. And the Missouri Public Defender System handles criminal cases but not civil cases. And we do both. And we try to combine that with social workers. So as Rick said, a lot of folks, if we resolve their legal issues, the issue isn't completely resolved. We can take care
That's
of
right.
the crisis of the moment, which is they've got a warrant for their arrest or someone's trying to kick them out of their apartment. But if a person's got a substance abuse problem or a mental health problem or some other exacerbating factor that's leading up to some of these legal problems, well, they're right back where they started, absent the crisis that we've resolved for them. And
Absolutely.
For most attorneys, that's the limit. A private attorney, certainly, no one asks a private attorney to get a social worker involved in a case. That's not at all the fact. In fact, years ago when I first founded the organization, I talked to Dan about this, and he said that in a perfect world, the public defender and legal services
Absolutely.
Would work together, but the funding and the statutory the statutes that founded the organizations prevent them from working together.
Yeah, that's right.
And the public defender used to have social workers on staff, but as Rick said, due to funding cuts, and it's brought it to the point where the real underlying problems that our clients, all of our clients, or the same clients are facing, are not able to get resolved with each one of our individual organizations. It takes a combination thereof.
You know, the thing about poverty is it does not exist in a vacuum. And that's why it's so critical that you provide holistic services. We also have social workers on staff. Not enough, you know, not enough lawyers, not enough social workers to deal with the issues. But Thomas is exactly right that it is a holistic element.
But define holistic for me. I'm not sure that everyone understands that term.
Well, holistic means a number of things. At Legal Services of Eastern Missouri, holistic means, I'll say, two things. One is We have 11 different substantive areas that we work in. So holistic means that someone can come in with domestic violence victim, which is one of the areas that we represent folks on, helping to get orders of protection and other legal remedies. But then they're going to find out because of that domestic violence, they're going to have a housing problem because the abuser has created a difficult situation for that individual, and they're going to lose their housing. So we have a housing unit, okay? We cross, you know, all these different areas. So that's one element, one way we're able to be holistic. The other way is that we do have social workers on staff, and so we are able, just as Thomas was saying, we are able to look at these the legal and socioeconomic issues that exist and try to you know, look at the whole elephant. You know, that's the key. But again, without enough resources, you can't look at as many elephants as you want.
So one problem leads to another, or is responsible for the other, and you have to deal with all of them in order to solve the initial problem.
Right. And another important thing is that we also network with 150 different social service agencies in the community. So we very much, you know, all of us are very much of the community. So yeah.
Rick, what's the caseload for a typical public defender in this area or this state?
Well, it varies by district. So, I mean, the numbers in St. Louis City are very different than those in St. Louis County, and there's a number of reasons that that happens. In St. Louis City, which is where I am, the numbers are probably in the 70s for each attorney, 70 clients charged with felonies. In the county, the numbers are higher, but in the city, we also have a number more trials. We had over 100 trials last year for our office alone, which is far more than any other office in the state. So the numbers are different. 75 is too many. Even though that may be half of what they have in St. Louis County, it's still too many for one attorney to have.
Boy, something has to get lost in the translation with that many cases. These are active cases at any given time.
They are. They are. They're active cases. They're in varying states of the process, whether it's pre-indictment, pre-arraignment, or they're ready for trial. And the attorneys in our office are regularly asked to be ready on a number of cases every single week for trial.
Thomas, do the attorneys you work with have that kind of a caseload?
No, we do not have that kind of caseload. It's, as Rick said, the public defender doesn't have a choice as to how many cases they take. There is a certain amount of leeway now about certain crimes that people are charged with. They can be deemed initially ineligible for the service of the public defender. But overall, they don't have that kind of choice. We started our organization only 4 years ago, and I had interned at the public defender, and my co-founder Michael John Voss and John McCanner had worked with legal services, and that was the birth of the idea, was how some of the issues that were raised to us by our, you know, by our peers, by our elders in the community, we tried to address it by establishing this organization, and one of them was caseload. It's very difficult to manage a caseload like that. It's difficult for the attorneys. It's difficult for the clients. The public defender has great lawyers. They do an amazing job, but it's under duress at all times.
Dan, how about the attorneys you work with?
You know, it varies depending on the substantive area you're working in terms of your number of cases. But, I mean, I think I would say, you know, on average is probably 40 or 50 cases or so. But here's the thing, you know, one key distinction is that, you know, as you mentioned, Gideon, at the outset, you know, there is a constitutional right to counsel in criminal cases. There is no such constitutional right in civil matters. Mm-hmm. So the good news, bad news is this. The good news is we do have choices and options about, you know, what cases we take. And, you know, we have to prioritize, sometimes even triage. You know, but the bad news is that means that the people that we're not taking, or Arch City Defenders can't take, or some of the others, you know, they are without counsel, and they just don't have a lawyer, and so that's really part of the gap. Yeah.
Well, the gap, and that's what we're talking about today, is the justice gap between the people who are accused of crimes who are well-to-do and those who are not well-to-do. And there is, in fact, as we've determined here today, there is, in fact, a justice gap. At least that's the opinion of our guests, who are Dan Glaser. You just heard from him, Executive Director of Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. Thomas Harvey is Executive Director of Arch City Defenders. And Rick Krueger is Deputy District Defender for Missouri's Public Defender System. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. If you'd like to get into to it, give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. If you feel that you have experienced this justice gap, we'd like to hear your story. We'll be back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on the justice gap in our area and across the country, as it turns out. But before we do that, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio and the Beacon Newsroom is following today. Governor Jay Nixon says his appointment of a Missouri lawmaker to the state parole board was based on merit and not politics. Several Republican senators have said they intend to block the confirmation of former House member Dennis Fowler. The governor says accusations that the appointment was a political reward are blatantly false. Lawyers for Superintendent Art McCoy and the Ferguson-Florissant School District could be days away from settling on a court date to hear charges that may lead to McCoy's termination. The school board placed McCoy on paid administrative leave in November for undisclosed reasons. His annual pay is more than $215,000 a year. And cases of flu among young adults in St. Louis are rising, and area hospitals are seeing more admissions and even some deaths. St. Louis County health officials say they plan to take steps to help address the problem. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Back to our conversation now on the justice gap. I noticed in the paper this morning there was a story about a young man who spent 58 days in jail because he was arrested by mistake. Apparently, they thought he was someone else. Is this an example? And I'll start with you, Rick. Is this an example of the justice gap?
I think it is. I mean, I absolutely think it is. If a person who has been arrested has the ability to call someone who can post a bond for them, then they get out and they can then from their home, from with their family, they can then adjust and figure out who should it be that was that should be locked up. And I think the clients like we have and the people that suffer in this gap are the ones who don't have the means to do that. They get locked up. They may call their family, but their family can't come up with funds. And so they have to sit there as the justice system slowly figures out who it is that should be there.
Something was cited that I'd not heard of before. It was called deliberate indifference in this case. Is that a common term?
It's a term that I studied in law school. I think we all did that. It's not something that I deal with in the criminal world anymore that much. So,
Thomas, what's your take on this particular situation?
Yes, I think it's representative of the justice gap. And I think let's be frank, if any one of the four of us were locked up in the city jail, it wouldn't have been for 58 days on a case of mistaken identity. If you're poor and you're a minority and you're saying, I'm not the person that you think should be locked up on this crime, people are not going to be listening to you as much as they would listen to any one of the four white males in this room.
Yeah. You know, one of the key things is giving our clients a voice. You know, that's what, you know, we try to do each and every day. And that voice would say the things that, you know, a low-income person who has been beaten down by the system and is used to not being heard will be that voice that will say what they would say if they had experience in their life or they had not been beaten down like so many of them have. And we'd say, let him out, you know.
You know, one of the things I noticed in this particular article was that someone, and I'm not sure who it was, said that he should have been his own advocate.
We were talking about this before. I find it unbelievable that he never said, I should be let out. I find that it's very hard to believe that a person who was locked up for 58 days on a case of mistaken identity never raised the issue to anyone. I think it's much more likely that he had been saying it and he'd been ignored. Because it's not the only time it ever happens. I mean, to the city's defense, I'm sure people say I'm the wrong guy all the time. But he wasn't taken seriously. I'm positive he raised that issue once or twice during that time.
Rick, when would a public defender be brought into a case like this, or would one have been?
Well, if a person is confined and they have charges pending, whether it's the right person or not, they can apply for our services. And if they qualify, if they're poor enough, then, you know, a public defender would enter. But we don't have the means to go scouring the jail to be the ones to figure out who's there that should be or shouldn't be. So if that person doesn't ask for us or doesn't qualify for us, then we don't get into it.
What are the criteria, the financial criteria for a public defender?
We follow the national poverty guidelines, and they have to be below it.
What's that, about $17,000 a year, something like that, or less?
I think it's less than that. To be honest with you, we have someone in our office who checks all of that every time,
sure.
So the numbers are...
I wonder, Dan, is there a bias in arrest rates?
Well, I think there are presumptions, you know, and you know what they say about people that assume things, right? And I have to say that I believe, when it comes to arrests, which we don't deal with arrest situations, mm-hmm. but when it comes to benefit of the doubt, you know, the reality is in our community, in our state, in our country, the benefit of the doubt does not go to the low-income person. You know, in baseball, they say tie goes to the runner. Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to the justice system, the tie, I have to say, normally does not go to the low-income person.
You know, I want to go to the phones, and we'll do so in just a moment. But during this discussion, what comes to mind is the case that I'm sure that all of you are familiar with that came to light a couple of weeks ago, the affluenza case about the young man who killed four people while he was driving while drunk and was given probation and sent to some pretty high-rent sort of facility for rehabilitation because he didn't have to follow the rules because he was wealthy. Go ahead, Thomas. You're ready to go.
I think it's a shocking outcome, but frankly, I don't know the law about juvenile defendants in that state. I have no way of saying whether or not an outcome of probation would have been outrageous in that state. I mean, we are talking about a minor. We're talking about a first-time offender who was a minor, as I understand it. Now, the fact that he made that his attorney, that they came up with a defense that says, I was too rich to understand the consequences and I was allowed to do everything in my life, that's obviously offensive. But I'm not sure that the outcome of probation is something that – but I will also add that his ability to say, my family will pay for treatment, that does factor.
Great
on
point.
The private side, if you've got someone who can say, I'll put my son, daughter, relative – into treatment as part of, I mean, and Rick can speak to this better than I could, but as part of plea negotiations that's huge. I mean, that's a massive advantage that wealthy people have.
Rick, I have to assume this is a defense that you have not used in your job.
It is not. No, but to echo what Thomas was saying, you know, one of the problems that we have is that you know, our clients have to, they're dependent on being able to get into the free services. And those are the places where people, whether they're facing criminal charges or not, are lining up to get into already when they have drug problems, alcohol problems. So our clients are certainly, you know, losing out because of that, whereas those who are wealthy enough to send someone to whatever state may have an open bed for them, it's a far different outcome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dan, did you want to comment on
that? No, I mean, just, you know, it's as we sort of started the program at the outset, it's not about the quality of the lawyering. I mean, we like to call ourselves, and Thomas and Rick would share that mantle. I mean, we're the poverty law experts. So if we get in there, you know, we are going to articulate things that will be helpful. But it's access to resources, just as Rick was saying, that, you know, that's where things get problematic.
Well, let's take some calls. We have a number of people who want to get into this discussion. Let's bring them in. We'll start with Jeff calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Jeff.
Hi, thank you. The Religion and Ethics News Weekly they covered the anniversary for Gideon versus Wainwright, and it raised a bunch of questions. Particularly, it seems that even when the public defenders are competent lawyers, which is clearly not always the case, there's effective incompetence due to the caseload. The particular case that was focused on in Religion and Ethics News Weekly involved a woman who was wrongly accused of arson in her apartment, which had electrical problems before she moved in there. She lost her job. She lost her home. She became homeless. And for 3 years, nobody took her case seriously until a lawyer named Stephen Bright with Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta intervened, and after 3 years, immediately, you know, with minimal investigation, proved that there was no case at all, and she finally, you know, it was dropped, and she got back to her life. I It seems that this is widespread. I know that that it's different from state to state, but that effective incompetence due to overload. But then also my other question is, I wonder if the gateway defenders, if there's any relationship, you know, with the Southern Center for Human Rights in Atlanta. Was one inspired by the other? That's my question.
All right, Jeff, thanks for the call. Thomas, you look like you're ready to fire, but you go ahead.
I'm not sure if that case was in Georgia, but I would like to point out that the Southern Center for Human Rights has done a lot of good work in Georgia suing the state for not providing attorneys to indigent defendants. Georgia did not have an organized public defender system. They didn't have a statewide public defender system. They had what has been proposed here, which would be give those cases to private attorneys. And then what you have is a series of meet 'em and plead 'em lawyers who are taking a stack of cases for $5,000, and there's an economic value in getting the bulk work done quickly. So I'm not sure if that case dates from that era. But Georgia just got an organized public defender system not so long ago, in part as a result of the efforts of Stephen Bright and the Southern Center for Human Rights.
Richter, do you want to comment on Jeff's remarks?
I think Thomas has covered it a great deal, yeah.
You know, I have here, again, in getting ready for this program, I went to the trusty old Internet, which is sometimes a good thing to do and sometimes dangerous. But let me read you something here that came out. And Rick, this will be pointed in your direction. It comes from a book, by the way, which is titled, Did You Have a Lawyer When You Went to Court? No, I Had a Public Defender. So you can tell where that's coming from. It says, the poor are often represented by a harried public defender or assigned attorney. One study found that most public defenders spend an average of 5 to 10 minutes with their clients. Even then, the subject of conversation is not the facts of the case, but plea bargaining strategies. Not surprisingly, public defenders win dismissals or acquittals in 17% of their cases, compared to 18% for assigned attorneys and 36% for privately hired counsel. Thoughts?
Well, I don't know the percentages here. I can tell you that I disagree with that in terms of the attorneys in my office. I know that they spend a great deal of time talking about the facts and talking about everything that the client has in terms of options, not just, well, here's the best way to get a deal. And in the city, we don't really get to negotiate very much anymore because the prosecutors have decided that they no longer want to. So that's not our approach. And I think that's also why we try so many cases in the city. So I think it may be accurate some places. I don't think it's accurate in St. Louis City, but there still are problems in terms of the ability to meet with enough clients. When you have 75 and more than half of them are confined and you have to go to the jail and try to wait for the jail to bring the clients to you because your clients can't post bond and come to your office and meet with you confidentially, there are all sorts of other problems.
And
go
and
ahead, Thomas.
To speak to that, I think it's a fairly – I hear this a lot where they focus on individual public defenders or individual lawyers who were paid by the state to represent someone, and they focus on that individual's failing. And from the defendants, from the person who has provided those services, that's the only thing that matters, and I understand that completely. However, if we take it to a macro level, the problem is not individual attorneys within the public defender system not wanting to spend time with their clients. It's that the state of Missouri doesn't fund the public defender system very well in the state of Missouri, and by comparison to other states in the United States, they fund them terribly. So if you want better services to the indigent, then allocate some funds for the public defender. Allocate more funds to legal services. I mean, it give money to the Arch City Defenders. It's a problem that has an answer, and the answer isn't individual attorneys who are paid low salaries by comparison to people in the private sector. They're not doing a bad job. They are doing the job it's possible for them to do under the circumstances.
And it doesn't seem in the spirit of Gideon versus Wainwright, does it, to have the system evolved in this manner?
No, absolutely not. That's right. I mean, the situation where you don't have the time, these are all good lawyers, but the situation where you don't have the time, that is constructive. Not access to justice, putting people in situations where they just don't have the appropriate time to do the work that needs to be done. That is, in fact, that is constructive non-access to justice. What we deal with is folks think, oh, my gosh, I'm getting a free lawyer. Well, I'm going to get what I paid for. because if you qualify for legal services, there is no charge for your services. Well, as I alluded to earlier, you know, we really are, you know, the experts, as everyone at this table, in the area of poverty law. So really what they're going to get is extremely dedicated people that this is what they want to be doing. I mean, everybody that's sitting at this table, this is what we wanted to do. This is why we went to law school. This is the difference we wanted to make. And, you know, when we can do it, when we can provide those services, they get the kind of access to justice that everybody in this country deserves.
I want to get to some other things, and will in just a moment. But while we're on this part of the discussion, let's bring in Phil calling from Baldwin. Phil, thanks for waiting. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, this is Phil.
Right.
I got a question. Have they ever seen the video by law professor James Duane, "Don't Talk to Police"? And the second question is, how many, on average, how many paying clients do private attorneys, criminal attorneys, have? And then on average, I mean, do they have an idea? And also, does your $17,000 poverty, is that a cutoff line for representation by the public defender's office? Or is the sliding scale above that? And one other question that I was listening to that I heard came up, how well trained are the public defenders? The Supreme Court of the United States has ruled that the prosecuting attorney's office does not have to train its prosecutors on protecting the rights of the accused individuals. And this has been repeated over the even though Amendment 14 was supposed to clarify the body of the U.S. Constitution, specifically Article 4, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution.
Phil, I'm going to stop you there. You've given us an awful lot to chew on. Let's get to as much of that as folks at the table can remember, and I'm sure it's more than I can, but thanks for calling. Thomas?
Oh, I was going to ask Rick to respond. Because I apologize to the caller, but the only thing I can remember is the question of the $17,000 cutoff. Is that a hard and fast number for the public defender? And then is there a sliding scale above that?
And I can address that. I haven't seen the movie he asked about, and I don't know what the average caseload is for private attorneys. I'm certain that it's not 75 plus. Mm-hmm. As far as the sliding scale, it is basically a sliding scale in this sense. We will make an initial determination as to whether or not the person qualifies based solely on numbers, based on what they own, what they make, what they owe, those kinds of things. But they have the right and the ability to appeal our decision if we say that you don't qualify. And so the court can still say this person may not qualify on his face, but I will still allow the public defender to enter, and then we can. As far as training, I think that the training the public defender offers is tremendous. We have internal training within each office, and then we also have statewide training. And all of the attorneys who come to the public defender went through law school just like all the private attorneys and passed the bar just as well as they did.
Right.
I could respond to that. Rick mentioned the private caseload, I actually, because we were a new organization and I founded it, I was working in private practice and still an attorney in private practice. And I can tell you the answer for most private attorneys is as many cases it takes to make the money you want to make, and then you can stop, right, if you ever reach that place. But in no way, shape, or form are people taking the hundreds and hundreds of cases like the public defender.
I want to pick up on that point when we come back, but we have to take a break. You just heard from Thomas Harvey, Executive Director for Arch City Defenders. Also with me in studio is Rick Kroger, Deputy District Defender for Missouri's Public Defender System, and Dan Glazer, Executive Director of Legal Services of Eastern Missouri. We're talking about the justice gap. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our discussion of the justice gap. With me in studio, Dan Glazer, Thomas Harvey, and Rick Kroger. By the way, Women's Voices Raised for Social Justice will be presenting Dan Glazer and Thomas Harvey for a discussion of the justice gap tonight at 7 o'clock at the Ethical Society on Clayton Road. So you're welcome at that event if you'd like to attend. 7 o'clock tonight at the Ethical Society. Now, back to an email, which I have in front of me here from John. He writes about the elephant in the studio. He writes, what contributions do to the justice inequality problem, a very real one, do lawyer fees and billing practices pay? Thomas, you just alluded to, you've take as many cases for as much money as you want to make. Bargain fees, John writes, of $125 per hour with billing for every phone call, email, and document printed from hard drive full of generic forms might be at the root cause of this inequality. Fees can be much higher. $150, $200 per hour aren't uncommon. It seems to me that this is the elephant in the room and in the KWMU studio. What do you think? That's pretty much the point you made in terms of fees that can be charged by private attorneys.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how that addresses what we're talking about in terms of the justice gap between the poor and the wealthy. But he's right. Those kind of hourly rates are not uncommon at all. And so I think it just goes to show that if you do have the money to pay for an attorney,
right,
you can afford those type of hourly rates. But I'm not sure how it responds to what we're doing.
Well, I think John had a separate point perhaps that he wanted to make. Is that, Dan, did you want to
No, I mean, something? I think that, the key again is, the quality of the representation you're going to get. And, as long as that quality, certainly from the perspective of the folks at this table and from the agencies we represent, the quality of the representation you're going to get is not reflected in an hourly rate.
Back to the phones. This time we'll bring in Brent calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Brent.
Yes, we need to think outside the box. This is not working. I think that if every trial lawyer were required to act as a public defender, we would come closer to uniform justice. I'm thinking of something like a lottery. They would raise their rates on the rest of us, but it would be a more efficient system in the end. It would be administratively more feasible, I think.
What do you mean by lottery, and how would that work?
Not a lottery like lottery, but I'm talking about like their name would be pulled up out of a database.
Like a jury pool kind of thing?
What did you say?
Lawyers' names would be pulled up sort of like the jury pool operates now?
Something like that, yeah. And just, any trial lawyer would be required to do public defender work.
Okay, go ahead, Rick.
I think that the biggest problem with that sort of a system is this, and I think it's been alluded to already by Thomas earlier, is that what would happen with those cases where the lawyer was appointed when that was sort of on the side of that lawyer's private practice is that case would also be treated as a side project which got little to no effort and just try to move the case along so that that attorney could focus on the cases and the clients that were bringing in the money. And so I think that that system ultimately would fail because of the lawyers still being driven by the money.
Not to mention they wouldn't have they may not have the expertise required to handle the case. I mean, one thing that should be mentioned about the public defender is they're taking probably only the most serious felony cases. So it's not as if they're dealing with we can do a volume on cases because they're municipal ordinance violations. It's very different if you've got, A and B felonies that people are charged with.
What about a system such as I understand you gentlemen were talking about before we went on the air? I was not part of the conversation, but apparently in some places, because of the lack of funding and financial resources for public defender's offices, they're providing vouchers of some sort of several thousand dollars that defendants can just take and go out and hire their own attorney. Is that essentially what you were talking about?
I mean, that did come up that's happening in some other jurisdictions. But I mean, there's all kinds of limitations to that. You don't want to be in a situation where you've got a cap on the amount of money you can spend. I mean, think about that. Justice. On a voucher. That if you say I can give you all the justice you deserve up to a point, and then that's it. You don't want that situation. That's not what the founders had in mind when they talked about. I mean, the concept of equal justice for all has meaning. And it's not equal justice for all until you reach your $5,000 cap as long as you have the assets. I mean, it's supposed to be an equal system. So I don't see I think you will get what you paid for, and there will be severe limitations in that regard.
Right.
It's actually something that I talk to my clients about, because I do have clients, and I think we've all come across this, that don't know that I'm a real attorney. And when trying to discuss that and explain to them what it is to be a public defender. One of the greatest things about my job is that never once have I had a client who said, well, I want a deposition done or a trial done, and I have to tell them, well, I'm not going to do that for you unless you come up with more money. If a client wants me to fight for them in trial, I do that regardless of their means. And I don't think that – I think the voucher system sort of lends itself to attorneys fighting only to what they believe $5,000 would be worth to them, whereas as a public defender, we do get to fight the battles regardless of how much money our clients have.
Any thoughts on that, Thomas, or should we move along?
I agree with what Rick and Dan said on that one.
Before I go back to the phones, let me bring up another couple of issues with regard to the justice gap, and I'll start with you, Dan, first on this. Do we see a justice gap in sentencing?
I think so. Now, we don't at Legal Services of Eastern Missouri deal with criminal sentencing, but I can certainly tell you, and I think recently it was brought up on the national stage. President Obama talked about it, and you know there does absolutely seem to be a disparity in the way we are sentencing. Defendants, it's almost like, there are assumptions. I can tell you that, again, when we walk into a grocery store or into a jewelry store or something like that, it's not assumed that we are there to maybe pilfer something. But when someone else, who ethnically is different, there are assumptions. And I think that does interact and tie in with sentencing as well. Now, it's subtle, nobody would probably acknowledge it, but I think they're probably, and Rick could answer this better because he deals with sentencing. I know there are statistics that probably look at that even more specifically.
Yeah. And I think we did talk about this a little bit in terms of the affluenza case, but I think another just sort of real world example, is what happens is that our clients can't make bond generally. And when they can't make bond, that means that they can't get out there and get a job to show the court that, hey, if I did this, I've turned myself around. I no longer am going to steal things because I have a job or I had a drug problem. And look at me, I've already gotten myself into rehab. So our clients can't get to the street. Because they can't get to the street, they can't start on these things ahead of time, whereas I think a lot of the more affluent clients or defendants, they certainly can. They can make the bonds that are high, which are, on gun cases are $30,000 cash only in the city. They can make bonds on those. They can make bonds on a number of other cases. And then when they go and they decide that they want to plead guilty, they're able to tell the judge, look, I'm working. I'm sober. I can, do a drug test right now to prove it. Here are all the other things I have in line. I'm working on my GED because I'm in school right now. I'm doing all of these things because I was able to afford to get out of jail, have a home, and go do them. Whereas our clients sit in jail, show up in front of a judge and say, I promise you if you let me out on probation, I'll try to do all these things that I should.
And perhaps they've been arrested by mistake.
True.
Exactly. Right, Thomas.
So this is one of the things that the Arch City Defenders provides that's unique among the legal services to the indigent in the community. We are able to get people out on bond as a result of our work with social work organizations. So many times when the homeless are locked up, one of the reasons you can't get out on bond is because you need an address that they can send the paperwork to and some certainty that you're going to show up to court next time. We can get them out on bond if we get them housing. We can get them housing if we can withdraw warrants in other cases. We can get them jobs. We can all the things that Rick is saying, which will lead to a better outcome on the criminal case, require the intervention of an attorney who can help you with the social aspect as well.
That's the holistic approach that we were talking
That's
about.
Right.
Yeah, our holistic approach is criminal and civil with social work.
I may have put the cart before the horse when I mentioned sentencing. Let me now take it back one step to the judge and the jury and their reaction to an indigent defendant. Is it likely, and perhaps, Rick, you know this better perhaps, is it likely that there would be a bias toward the poor defendant?
I think it is. I will tell you that when I go into trial, I ask the court to and I ask the prosecutor to agree to not call me a public defender. And it's not because I'm not proud of what I do. It's actually because I have had myself referred to as a public defender in court. And many jurors have said, well, if he were innocent, his family would have gotten together money and they would have hired him a real lawyer. And then I spend 20, 30 minutes in voir dire, jury selection, trying to dispel that issue. So I try to avoid it because I think there are certain biases that will be held against my clients.
Dan?
You know, a corollary in this in the civil side is what money judgments mean to low-income people. You know, when you have some means and
– We're talking a civil case
in
now.
A civil case. Mm-hmm. And you have – for example, a hospital bill maybe that is expensive. You deal with it. You have resources. When you are low income, that hospital bill that you're not able to pay will lead to a judgment against you. And a judgment against you may lead to a garnishment against you. And a garnishment against you, if you are working, may lead to all kinds of problems in the workplace. Or it may, and that will tie in to your housing. Because, you know, if you don't have the resources. So it's a, you know, I often say that a what would be a stub of a toe to people with means, you know, is a mountain for low-income people.
Why should this justice gap be important to people who are not caught up in this cycle?
It's insanely expensive to the taxpayer to continue to incarcerate and house people who are primarily there as a result of their lack of means. In the municipal court system, there are people being locked up on warrants for failure to pay fines. Admittedly, they didn't show up to court to pay their fines, so they got locked up on a warrant as a result. But then they're locked up in a municipality, or the municipality doesn't have the means to have its own jail, so they rent space from the county or one of the other municipal jails at a cost to those taxpayers in order to collect fines that they're never going to collect from our clients. So it's a financial issue. There's a strong argument to be made that this is not only the right thing to do morally and ethically to treat our fellow human beings well, but also economically. It does not make sense for us to think as a region. I mean, with the municipalities, it's very much the one municipality arrests the citizen of another municipality and locks them up, which impacts that neighboring municipality's economic outcomes. It's something that we don't do well in St. Louis at all, is think of ourselves as a region and to think about the ways that those individual actions impact everybody.
I'm going to try to get one more call in as time begins to get away from us. Susan, go ahead with your question or comment, please.
Hi. This is a great discussion. In Southern Illinois, we have something called People's Law School, and we have a law day run, and I haven't heard about either one of them for several years, unfortunately. I just wanted to give a kind of a corollary example.
Make it quick, though, please, Susan.
Okay. I contacted the ombudsman about something in my mother's care in a nursing home, and he covers 15 counties. She's deceased. He said there is no way he's going to go near that situation. He is so overburdened with cases and work.
I guess that kind of makes the point that we've been making throughout. Thomas, did you seem to be reacting to what she was saying?
There's an organization in town called Voices. They've recently changed their name. They're now called Voices, and they do some of that work. She may want to contact them. They may be able to help them out. And I'm not sure what their contact information is.
We only have a few seconds left. Is there anything that the accused can do for themselves? Any action that they can take, the people who are caught in this gap? We have about a minute.
You know, I think knowledge is a powerful thing. And the more you know, the more you know your rights, the more you know that you have a right in the greatest country on earth, many would say, to not have to deal with this kind of inequality. But the main thing is education and access. And the more resources that all of us at this table have, the more we are able to provide that critical help.
Rick Kroger, anything you can add to that?
I would echo what Dan said. I think that trying to get their voices together to show the rest of the community and the rest of the world what problems they have because of this and the system, you know, locking people up wrongfully, things like that, raising that issue, showing that could happen maybe to other people, maybe get more support is something that we could do.
And in a few seconds, Thomas.
I agree completely. It's a question of getting those voices together and thinking about policy change, because there's a limitation on what judges, prosecuting attorneys and criminal defense attorneys can do once the law has been established.
All right. Well, that's Thomas Harvey, Executive Director of Arch City Defenders. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dan Glazer, thank you for being with us. He's Executive Director of Legal Services. These two gentlemen tonight will be at the Ethical Society on Clayton Road to continue the discussion of the justice gap under the auspices of the Women's Voices Raised for Social Justice. Also with me in studio is Rick Kroger, Deputy District Defender for Missouri's Public Defender System. Thank you so much, all of you, for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape, when he'll take a look at how three St. Louis Symphony musicians have helped the actors in the Rep's production of Opus successfully portray members of the string quartet. He'll also talk with William Stage about his book highlighting ads painted on the sides of St. Louis buildings, which are fading with age, and with Joe Hanrahan about his roles in a one-man play dramatizing the true story of the world's greatest Shakespeare forger. Monday on St. Louis On the Air, we'll talk about the final brief in the Forsake of All study examining the health and well-being of African Americans in St. Louis and St. Louis County. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. This program is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with the production assistance from Camille Phillips, Aaron Dorr, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. Executive producer is Robert Peterson. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.